Hello, everyone. I'm Bill Roggio. I'm a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies and editor of FDD's Lone War Journal. This is Generation Jihad, the podcast that covers all things in what used to be known as the global war on terror, but we now call the Long War.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this week's episode of Generation Jihad. I'm your co-host for Freaky Fridays, Behnam Bentaleblu. Bill Roggio is out, but we are joined with a good friend, former colleague, and perhaps you could say Washington's best expert on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. He's the man who's been writing the biographies of the chief terrorist and former lead of the Quds Force, Qasem Soleimani, for years and years and years before they went mainstream. It's a pleasure to have Ali Alfoneh, now with the AGISW, author of several books, including Iran Unveiled, with us on the Generation Jihad podcast for Long War Journal. Ali, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Behnam, for your kind invitation, and thank you for providing me with this opportunity to share my analysis with you. I truly like, you know, the title of your show, but you know, jihad comes in many different forms. You know, one of them is also a jihad to make people more knowledgeable about, you know, things that are happening around us. So I hope that today's program is going to be a jihad for knowledge.
Yes, we can do the jihad and nafs together.
Exactly.
Let's dive right in. You know, the one pulling the trigger, either in response to April 1st or on April 13 or April 14, is the entity that you've been spending your professional life covering, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. First of all, can you tell us on the lead up to this? Not how surprised were you by the nature of the Israeli operation in Damascus that killed Brigadier General Zahedi, as well as some other I think at least one other Brigadier General, one Armed Forces General Staff member, and other IRGC individuals, but because we've seen Israel periodically attack Iranian officials, military officials, inside and outside the country, that was not a unexpected move. But what was unexpected for you up until April 13, 14, and what caused this shift in the IRGC? And do you believe what reportedly General Salami, the head of the Guard Corps, has said about a shift in the doctrine of the Guard Corps before we get to what happened last night?
If there was any element of surprise concerning Israel's moves, it was that Israel hit a diplomatic building. Now, I realize that there are some individuals who argue that this was not a part of the embassy. It was an annex, you know, and all the sorts of it. But that was the only part which we could argue was somewhat surprising concerning Israel's active actions. I was mostly surprised by Iran's response, because Iran has exercised this policy of strategic patience at least since the beginning of the civil war in Syria in 2011. Iran deployed forces gradually. You know, first it was Hezbollah militia fighting the war on behalf of Iran in Syria to stabilize the Bashar al-Assad regime. But as Lebanese Hezbollah came under pressure, suffered many losses, Iran deployed Afghan militias, but also Revolutionary Guard, you know, Quds Force and other parts of the Revolutionary Guard in order to come to the aid of Lebanese Hezbollah. Israel responded, you know, to Iran's deployment of forces in Syria, was systematically attacking Iranian and allied positions in Syria, was also targeting Iranian arms transports to Lebanese Hezbollah through Syria and Syrian territory. And Iran's response was almost non-existent. I do believe that it was only on one or two occasions that Iran shot a few, it was not even missiles. Actually, I think it was artillery pieces that Iran shot back at Israel, but it was largely symbolic. And Iran's patience, I believe, was the right policy back then. The Iranian analysts believe that Iran could take those and could sustain those small-scale losses in Syria. In return, they managed to achieve two extremely important objectives. First of all, they did manage to secure the survival of the Assad regime. And secondly, they gradually began to create some kind of a dormant front against Israel, which can potentially be activated in the future. And those small losses was really not such a big matter. So the question, of course, is why Iran responded to the April 1st attack in Syria. And my suspicion is that it was Mr. Khamenei's input. This was not a policy which was approved of by the Supreme National Security Council. Usually, whenever there is a crisis, the Supreme National Security Council convenes, they debate the crisis, and they come up with policy recommendations, first of all, to the President of the Republic, and then President of the Republic presents those policy options to the Supreme Leader. This time around, we saw the reversal of the process. It was Mr. Khamenei making a promise in public that Iran would retaliate against Israel. Then he tasked the Supreme National Security Council to come up with specific solutions concerning how to respond to it. Now, in other words, the fundamental question, if Iran should or should not respond to Israel, was not even debated in the Supreme National Security Council. And this, I believe, led to the miscalculation of the attack on April 13th. This attack was not in Iran's interest. This was not something that has served Mr. Khamenei well since.
Do you agree? It's my view. I think I've said it publicly that this move risks. Now, we know we're just living in the aftermath of some sort of Israeli strike. My view is that this thus far is a drone strike, particularly like a quadcopter strike, like we've seen allegedly the Israelis do twice before. These drones ironically require you to be in territory because of the limited range. There was even a joke I heard from an Iranian friend before April 14, which was that if the aerospace force really wanted to hit Israelis, they should have fired at the Supreme Leader's office. They would have had better luck killing Israelis there than they would killing Israelis in Israel. It just goes to show you the dark humor of some Iranians at the moment. But all of that aside, did the regime paint a target on its back? And with the attacks, you know, attributed to Israel yesterday/this morning, has it survived that? And is this a de-escalation cycle now in otherwise what was, at least for me, who looks at the missile stuff, historic and precedent-setting and game-changing?
De-escalation, yes, but not because of Iran, you know, mostly because of the United States. The United States managed to persuade Israel to respond in a very, very restrained way. Now, we do not know if this was just the first, you know, round of a wave of Israeli attacks against Iran, or this was it. If it actually was it, it was the United States and not Iran, you know, who managed to restrain Israel and to de-escalate a crisis. And Iran appears to be willing to accept this as a de-escalation. Iranian media, particularly, you know, the mouthpieces of the Supreme National Security Council, Noor News Agency, but also Mashreq News Agency and other, you know, mouthpieces of the Revolutionary Guard, are trying to downplay the significance of the Israeli response, which means that they are accepting the situation, you know, and I think some kind of a balance has been established between Iran and Israel. This obviously is a good thing from the Islamic Republic's point of view. My concern was that the Islamic Republic actually had entered the trap of Prime Minister Netanyahu. Why did Prime Minister Netanyahu, for years and years, systematically attack Iranian positions in Syria? Because he wanted to provoke Iran to retaliate. And once Iran retaliated, Israel could play the role of the victim and then call the United States and say that the United States should fight Israel's war against Iran for Israel, on Israel's behalf. Now, Iran was too clever and did not walk into Israel's trap for all those years, but suddenly it did. And this, I believe, was Mr. Khamenei's mistake. Now, I do believe that it is not so much Mr. Khamenei himself and his team, but the United States, which has managed to de-escalate the crisis.
There's a couple of trend lines, or in Persian we say sarnakh, little pieces of string that come from the multiple answers in your response. One is about Israeli potential baiting. One is about Khamenei versus the Guard Corps' risk tolerance. And then the other is about strategy. Let me start with the strategy, and then we can work backwards. I had actually seen this to be a non... in a factional, in a non-factional way, but I actually seen this far exceeding Prime Minister Netanyahu in the sense that, yes, there was the military responses by Israel in Syria, the attacks, the great, the, what they used to call the campaign between the wars, the war between the wars, the mowing of the liver, all sorts of phrases for not defeating Iran in Syria, but for trying to check but not checkmate, erode the capability, increase the military cost. And I think even before the JCPOA or right after the JCPOA, an Israeli friend showed me a cartoon. And I think you may have seen this because it went all over social media and they translated, but it was in Hebrew. And it was Rouhani and some, at that time, former President Rouhani and an IRGC official on a tarmac. And somebody was moving, you know, crates of ammunition into a plane for delivered to Syria. And then the joke was that Rouhani turns to the Guard Corps and says, "Isn't it cheaper if we just blow it up here?" You know, the same kind of philosophy that, you know, this is going to get blown up anyway. It didn't destroy Iran's presence in Syria, but it prevented it from going the extra mile. While all of this was going on, there were a series of sabotage attempts, cyber attacks that happened, I think, under the Bennett government in Israel as well. So I saw this as kind of a non-factional proposition, that there was consensus that something below the threshold for the use of force was going to be needed by Israel, and that it could be expanded to Iran safely. Am I correct in thinking that? And then two is, I see the Israelis as potentially trying to test what is the drop with the Iranians that pushes them out of the bucket, but I don't know if it was a concerted strategy to force somebody who fights in the shadows and is strong asymmetrically to come out and punch back publicly and fight publicly, but is weak conventionally. I don't know if that was a transition they wanted to foster, or it was an attempt to test, does Iran even have a red line? Because there was a quote I focused on it a lot. I don't know if, you know, you tell me if I overfocused. Hassan Danaifar, the former Quds Force, Iranian ambassador to Iraq, post-Saddam, used literally the word strategic patience and used literally the words you mentioned, that this is a trap and we should not fall into it. You attribute that to no Supreme National Security Council process rather than perhaps the Guard Corps wanting to flex its muscles? Some of their elite members were killed, or you attribute that to something emotional in Khamenei? Usually he seems to be a risk-averse individual. What forced you to break these trends and precedents?
When it comes to Israel's approach, my reading of Israel's approach is that Israel truly wanted to bait Iran. They wanted to bait Iran to leave the JCPOA. They wanted, you know, Iran to break with the JCPOA by, you know, having the U.S., persuading the U.S. government, you know, to designate the Revolutionary Guard in its entirety as a terrorist organization. The Israelis were interested in having the Trump administration leading the JCPOA. And they were hoping that Iran would also go out of JCPOA, increasing the possibility of a U.S.-Iran war. It would be much more pleasant from Israel's point of view if it was the United States fighting Israel's war with Iran rather than Israel fighting, you know, the fight against Iran directly. Why would they do this if it is U.S. taxpayers and U.S. Blood and treasure being used, you know, for fighting that war? Now, turning to Iran's side of the debate, you are correct. You know, there was not actually so much of a difference between President Rouhani and the Revolutionary Guard. Their approach was actually very similar. Both of them believed in strategic patience, and both of them believed that this policy was serving Iran very well. They were aware that they were paying a price in order to encircle Israel, in order to have a, you know, establish a presence, military presence in Syria, which at some point in the future can be used against Syria. They knew that, and they were willing to pay the price, and they were patient. What happened, you know, up to the decision, you know, to engage in the attack against Israel on April 13th, was that Mr. Khamenei, I believe, was too impacted by public opinion inside of Iran. He believed that he was under pressure to do something, and he said something in public. President Raisi is not like President Rouhani. President Rouhani was experienced. You know, he's an individual with national security decision-making. He is experienced because of the fact that he himself was both in the Supreme Defense Council and later the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. He was an individual who could stand up to Mr. Khamenei if Mr. Khamenei was somehow a hostage of his own feelings, or he was afraid too much of the domestic opinion. President Raisi lacks those qualities. President Raisi is not a leader. He is somebody who says yes to all the impulses of Ayatollah Khamenei. The Revolutionary Guard came up with a plan. No cabinet minister in the Supreme National Security Council contested the plan presented by the Revolutionary Guard. This we know from a vice minister of Interior. Apparently, Iran has a vice minister of Interior for Palestine affairs. God knows why the Interior minister has such a vice minister. But this
are they the ones annexing now? If it's interior of the country, are they annexing Palestine?
Very strange phenomenon. But this, you know, Mr. Abtahi, with whom I was not familiar until a few days ago, he delivered an interview in which he disclosed that there was no dissent within the Supreme National Security Council when the plan to retaliate against Israel was being planned. Now, that is very, very surprising. How come there was not a single individual in the entire Supreme National Security Council warning of the consequences? So these are very, very worrying tendencies that I'm seeing right now under President Raisi, because President Raisi is not giving any opposition or resistance to the impulses of Ayatollah Khamenei.
For the Generation Jihad audience, we're talking about the SNSC, the Supreme National Security Council, perhaps the most important but least studied national security decision-making body in Iran. A lot of Ali's scholarship and work, and I would like to say conversations with cigars with me, we've focused on the eerie institutionalization of policymaking in the Islamic Republic, whereas one might say it was haphazard, or in the classic Shia sense, the son of the cleric administers the Beit or the house. Under Khamenei, there seems to be an institutionalization. This is a break from even the pattern of absolutism or authoritarianism in Iran. Ali, could you talk a little bit for the audience? Because again, most of our audience focuses on terrorism and sometimes what we call the Sunni side of the street. The recent change at the NSC, we have Ahmadiyyan. Who is Ahmadiyyan? But also, you mentioned the lack of a debate or a lack of a pushback on the consensus. What do we need to know anything about the members on this council?
The composition of the council more or less reflects, you know, what is written in the Constitution of the Islamic Republic. You know, before the constitutional revision in 1989, Iran had a very important decision-making body called the Supreme Defense Council. It was the Supreme Defense Council making all the strategic decisions during the Iran-Iraq War. After the constitutional revision of 1989, Supreme National Security Council was established, and you know, Mr. Hassan Rouhani was the first secretary of this council. Most of the strategic cabinet ministries are represented in the council. So are the heads of the powers of the state. So, you know, the president or an individual representing the presidency, the head of the executive branch of government is there. And then we have, of course, the head of the judiciary and the parliamentary speaker. So this is an extremely important institution. Institutions reflect the viewpoints, you know, of themselves. There is a very serious debate inside of Iran. Within the Supreme National Security Council, it is a serious body with serious debates. And the mood, I understand, with several individuals who have served in the Supreme National Security Council, is very democratic. You know, everybody has a say. Now, obviously, when it comes to military security, hard security of Iran, the bodies such as the Revolutionary Guard, the Quds Force, and even the regular military, they have a greater say in the affairs. But every single cabinet ministry, they have a representative, you know, all the strategic ministries, and they express their opinions that they have reached, you know, the conclusions that they have reached within their own bureaucracy. So they reflect their bureaucratic interests, you know, they express it at the council meetings. When they adopt a policy, usually they try to achieve some kind of a consensus. This, the role of the secretary, you know, the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, is to somehow align the difference and sometimes conflicting interests of the different parts of the bureaucracy, different cabinet ministries, achieve some degree of consensus. But you know, it's not always possible. You know, so there will be some kind of a majority decision, and he has to loyally present these policies to the president, and the president brings these policies to Mr. Khamenei so that he can make a decision.
Isn't there a lot of opportunity for telephone in between these things, that the secretary to the president, you know, the game telephone where the message changes with the distance, the secretary, the consensus to the secretary to the president to the supreme leader, and then back down to the...
Unfortunately, this is impossible for us to know. You know, the only insight that we have to the workings of the Supreme National Security Council actually comes from the memoirs of Mr. Rafsanjani. There are references to the works of the Supreme National Security Council by some former secretaries, you know, for example, you know, Mr. Rouhani himself and others, but he's really, really limited. You know, so that part I do not know. But what we do know, and it is very important, is that Mr. Khamenei never imposes his policy preferences on the Supreme National Security Council. So there are even examples where Mr. Khamenei accepts a policy which he himself is against. Now, you could ask, you know, why is Mr. Khamenei accepting a majority decision from the Supreme National Security Council if he himself is against it? Well, he does so because he does not want to be held personally responsible if a policy adopted by him and proposed by him is disastrous.
Just for our audience, is consistent with how he hedged, sold, created political space for, and then undermined the JCPOA.
Exactly. If he imposes his own decision on the council and there is a disastrous outcome, he will be personally held responsible. So he usually accepts and respects majority decision, you know, from the Supreme National Security Council. What happened in this case is that, first of all, the new secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, he probably was not listening or encouraging different parts of the bureaucracy to express their opinions. And these individuals, they were also too timid to express an opinion, even their bureaucratic interests, because Mr. Khamenei had already demanded revenge. He wanted to have actions against Israel. Then these cabinet ministers and their representatives, they simply did not dare to raise a critical viewpoint in the Supreme National Security Council. And President Raisi himself, he's not an individual who is going to stand up to Mr. Khamenei. He lacks the character and he is not responsible enough to protect Mr. Khamenei against Mr. Khamenei's own worst impulses. And that led to the decision for Iran to retaliate against Israel. Had it not been for the restraining impact of the U.S. government, Israel could have responded in a much harder way, and it would have been disastrous for the Islamic Republic. So Iran, and I have to say, Mr. Khamenei was lucky that President Biden persuaded Israel to limit its response to Iran.
I would go one step further, but I think we would disagree on this, in the sense that I think the telegraph, as much as there was talk of the telegraphing, if you will, of the strike, the Biden administration, in my view, has telegraphed not just its policy, but its philosophy towards the Islamic Republic. And the philosophy that they telegraphed, both in the campaign, then in the early negotiation period, and then after the breakdown of negotiations and in all of the secret talks, is that they believe pressure is counterproductive, and that while some U.S. partners in the region are looking for deterrence by punishment, the Biden administration is looking for de-escalation and deconfliction. And that's been a relatively consistent philosophy, I think. And I think the Iranians, you know, sometimes we might think that they have a view of the U.S. as in just left, right, center, everybody's the same. Whereas I think the JCPOA experience, the Iraq war experience, everything got them exposed to a different side of the American body politic. And I think they learned, like, just as much as that there is a nonpartisan mass desire, national desire for the U.S. to leave, there is a bipartisan elite desire for the U.S. To stay. To that end, didn't he factor in that Iranian deterrence would be bolstered by American restraint? Wasn't that part of some kind of a strategic calculation, or are we granting them too much kind of knowledge or strategic agency that they would have factored in that there are two things that the Iranians, and I'll get to the second one after you answer this, but there are two things that might prevent an Israeli overt attack on the scale of which we saw from Iran against Israel, and they are not capability. The first is my supposition that they could play to those instincts from the administration about restraint. Am I right that they could bake that in? And then once you answer that, I'll ask the second one.
Well, you know, U.S. actions and the policy preferences and policy approach, or if you want, you know, philosophy of the Biden administration concerning the Islamic Republic, obviously reflects, you know, the pivot to Asia, you know, and the fact that this administration is not particularly interested in getting entangled in another forever war in the Middle East. This simply is not the policy preference of the Biden administration. And by the way, it was not even a policy preference of President Trump. Neither were interested in entangling the United States in a war with Iran. Now, can the U.S. punish the Islamic Republic short of entangling itself in a war in the Middle East? I do not know. But clearly, they don't believe that it is possible, which is why President Trump, you know, punish Iran militarily. And Biden administration is also showing great degree, not only itself of restraint, but is also trying to restrain Israel. So that is their approach. And as for Ayatollah Khamenei and his ordering of the attack against Israel on April 13th in order to establish some kind of a deterrence, if Israel's response to Iran is limited to what we saw last night, then perhaps Ayatollah Khamenei's gamble paid off. This does not change the fact that the policy process, you know, the strategic decision-making process in Tehran is flawed. Mr. Khamenei made the decision and then asked the Supreme National Security Council to you know, find a solution. This is not the way for Iran to make strategic decisions. One individual can commit terrible mistakes. And I do believe that, you know, Mr. Khamenei miscalculated. He is lucky that his gamble perhaps is paying off. Now, the second part of your question was extremely important, because what if Israel engages in, let's say, cyber attacks, you know, or attacks which are not necessarily visible? Here, I think what is important for the Islamic Republic is not just the substance. I do believe that the context and the way it is perceived by the Iranian public is also very important. And I do believe that Mr. Khamenei does not want to lose face in public. He does not want to be perceived as weak. So he would perhaps be and can live with, you know, Iran being subject to cyber attack. If it is not necessarily known to the broader Iranian public, but having smoke coming out of Iran's nuclear facilities would be a disastrous blow to his prestige, which is why we saw one of the commanders in charge of the physical security of Iran's nuclear facilities.
Yes, this is my second point. Yes.
Yesterday, talking about a revision of Iran's nuclear doctrine and Iran reneging and revising its previously messaged approach to the nuclear issue. As I read it yesterday, Iran was practically ready to argue that, you know, Iran was ready to wave goodbye to the so-called nuclear fatwa prohibiting Iran to produce a nuclear weapon.
And even the NPT. And even
Absolutely.
Exactly. There's a small diversion. But so this was the second prong. I think deterrent, what underwrote the strike by Iran, in your view, one of the major causal factors is this national security flawed decision-making, which is exceptionally consistent with your scholarship of the bureaucratic decision-making apparatus in Iran, the individual, the process, the policy, and then the organization. I was looking at it in this strategic sense of what they could count on to make a gamble, because I've seen a trend line in rising missile operations. What was so shocking for me is that Iran has never publicly launched not just ballistic missiles against Israel, but ballistic missiles against a defended target. And not only a defended target, the mother of all defended layered air and missile defenses with Western support. So this is like we go out for a risotto and I don't put black pepper, but tomorrow I drink two bottles of Tabasco sauce. You know, one doesn't correlate with the other. You have to train yourself on the spice level. And the Iranian missiles were not trained on more and more of these advanced air and Western defenses. So there had to be, in my view, for you, it is some kind of flawed policymaking that pushed this strategic miscalculation. In my view, it was a strategic overconfidence in a couple of things. One, I think they believed the hype of some of their missiles. Two, I think they had a relatively sticky reputation, sticky impression that America was not going to get involved. Three, I think this gets to the politics point, that they could count on Biden's restraining force on Israel. And four is what you touched on, and I'm trying to articulate this in a piece, is the nuclear element. There is a whole series of comments, actually, that we can go back to. I think it was Alavi, the former intelligence minister, with his line, I think 2018 or 2019, about don't corner a Persian cat or, you know, it'll come back. There's a whole series of rhetorical arguments Iranian officials are putting out there to say, we have a threshold capability, but if you push us, we will have to do something with that threshold capability and move from latency into a capability. I actually think in that period of transition, it's equally as dangerous for Israel and America as it would be as dangerous for Iran. But you've had the Ali Akbar Salehi comments, you've had the Kamal Kharazi comments, you've had occasional hinting by Mohammad Islami, the head of the Atomic Energy Organization, but nowhere as gross as the Salehi comments. Yesterday, I believe the IRGC individual's name, Haqtalab was his name, was perhaps the most grotesque version of this that we've ever seen. I expect this to be weaponized more and more in the future, the more advanced the civil nuclear capabilities become, and to function as a deterrent sort of Damocles against pressure. And am I wrong in thinking this? And then the second thing from that is, and this is going to have almost shattering policy implications for DC, in a world where Iran's conventional deterrence dampens, the salience of nuclear deterrence rises. Would I be correct in assessing that trend line?
You are absolutely right concerning some degree of overconfidence, you know, particularly among the Revolutionary Guard officers in the IRGC Air and Space Force. They had certain beliefs concerning their capabilities, but a correct, you know, a healthy process within the Supreme National Security Council is actually a process trying to restrain this degree of overconfidence. And the process gets flawed when you have a president who is not willing to stand up to Mr. Khamenei, and you have cabinet ministers who simply don't dare to oppose the Revolutionary Guard in the Supreme National Security Council. Despite the fact that their own cabinet ministry, you know, their bureaucracy tells them and encourages them to oppose the Revolutionary Guard and these kind of impulses. So when I'm talking about, you know, a flawed process, this is exactly what I mean. And by the way, this is not just Israel. Before Israel, we saw one case of Iran firing a missile at
Pakistan.
Another nuclear power, Pakistan, which was equally, I have to say, shocking. Who authorized this? Was it Mr. Khamenei who authorized this? Was it the Revolutionary Guard overinterpreting the permission and the green light that Mr. Khamenei had given them to respond to terrorist attacks in Sistan-Baluchistan province, we simply don't know because there is no transparency within the decision-making process in the Supreme National Security Council. And as for Iran and the nuclear bomb, I do believe that Iran right now is a nuclear threshold state, and inefficacy of the missiles, you know, because of the simple fact that most of them, or if not all of them, were intercepted by Israel and the U.S. and others, Iran will feel compelled, particularly if under threat of further Israeli attacks or possibly a U.S. attack, Iran will feel compelled to pursue the nuclear weapon, you know, in a much more serious way than before. So I'm not particularly surprised by the kind of responses and statements that we are hearing from Tehran. This is, in some ways, the weapon of the week. Iran cannot compete with Israel when it comes to conventional weapons, and therefore has to reach strategic parity by other means. So this is not particularly surprising.
That's a lot to chew on. Ali Alfone, Senior Fellow, Resident Scholar at AGISW, author of Iran Unveiled. We appreciate you. There's a lot to continue the conversation with, hopefully next day over at Cigar, and we'd love to have you back. I think you've enlightened the minds with a peaceful jihad today. Thank you for your time.